I'm Jay Moran.
I'm Bridget Jaipal Valenza.
I'm Thomas O'Neill White.
We need to get together and let our voices be heard.
This is What's Next. A dedicated hour to have important conversations about the issues facing the marginalized and underrepresented communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario.
If we're going to have some real healing, we've got to have space to tell some uncomfortable truth.
What's Next continues our mission to discuss race,
equity,
and the common concerns of Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
This is What's Next. I'm host Thomas O'Neill White, and joining me today to talk about advancing tobacco-free communities in Western New York is Rashawn Smalls, the program manager for Tobacco-Free Erie and Niagara through Chickatelli Associates Incorporated. Thank you for being on with us, Rashawn.
No, it's a pleasure, brother. I appreciate the opportunity.
Of course, of course. Can you give us a little bit of a background of Chickatelli Associates? What goes on over there?
Yeah, sure. So again, my name is Rashawn Smalls, and I am blessed to serve as the Community Engagement Program Manager for Advancing Tobacco-Free Communities, which I'll have opportunity to talk about a little bit later. But that is a project of Chickatelli Associate, or short CAI for short, CAI Global. And CAI is a public health organization, not-for-profit, which has been around for probably about 45 years or so. I believe it was 1979. And we're a capacity-building organization. And so essentially, our mission is to use the transformative power of education and research to create a more aware, a more healthy, a more compassionate, a more equitable world. So the work that we do fits within through the, that social lens.
And so, and then your role in the organization is a broad approach to eliminating cigarette use.
Yeah, and so that is certainly one way of describing it. So the work that we do, I want to just simply start by saying that Advancing Tobacco-Free Communities is a statewide project. It is part of New York State's chronic disease prevention agenda, and so Advancing Tobacco-Free Communities, there is this focus on supporting New York State's smoke-free norms. There is an individual like myself in just about every county throughout the state. I and my coworker Amanda, who isn't here today, we both serve as program managers, and we work across both Erie and Niagara County. She does Reality Check, which is the youth component to the work that we do, and her focus is on developing youth leaders to use their voice to message against how tobacco industry is targeting our community. And my role on the other end is to complement that right there through community engagement. And the focus is on, again, supporting New York State smoke-free norms through a number of different approaches or initiatives.
So before we get into initiatives, mm-hmm. what are tobacco-free norms?
And so when you think about tobacco-free norms, let me give it some, try to give you what tobacco-free norms isn't, or an example of what a norm is, for instance, mm-hmm. right? So let's think about stop signs, right? You know, everyone can relate to stop signs. Some of us like them, some of us hate them,
yeah.
You know, especially when you got to get to where you got to go to, right? So stop signs are there for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
Stop signs stop people from, it creates order, right? It creates it's a rule that help save lives in some instances, in many instances, right? Because if we didn't have stop signs, we'd all be running through and moving at our own pace, at our own tune, and we'd end up crashing.
Mm-hmm.
So there are laws, you know, even texting while driving, right? That right there is distracting, and it could cause harm because you may not see the car that's going in the opposite direction, or you may swerve and hit another car. So those are rules or policies, right? Norms that have been ingrained in our way of life. So when you think about smoke-free norms, the goal here is to protect and save lives by reducing exposure to secondhand smoke, right? Because if, for instance, I live in a multi-unit housing complex, right? And 70% of the occupants smoke in this housing complex. And I, among the 30%, don't smoke,
mm-hmm.
right? But every day I'm going to work and my clothes smell like tobacco.
Right.
My 5-year-old infant is inhaling secondhand smoke from my neighbor, right? So when we talk about creating or working to establish smoke-free norms, is it about, if I live in this housing complex, do I have a right to breathe clean air? And how do we establish that right there? You know, and one of the ways that we've worked on it, and we'll talk about it later, is by working with multi-unit housing complexes, property owners and property managers to adopt and implement smoke-free policies, which in effect restrict smoking and reduce secondhand smoke. And, you know, and that's, I guess in some ways people don't like it, but the reality is what it does is it's a policy, a rule, but eventually it becomes a way of life, like stop signs, like texting while not texting while driving, or not drinking while driving, and some of the other smart public health policies which save lives.
So working with these property owners to get that policy in, you know, has there been pushback from policy owners? I'm sure there's pushback from people living in those units who smoke, but from a property manager's perspective, have they been like fully on board?
Yeah, well, that's the straight cut answer is no, right? Because with any type of implementation of policy comes with its challenges, right?
Yes.
And in COVID sort of exacerbated many issues, right? And one of the issues are many landlords struggled to get their money simply from tenants, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if, you know, I'm telling you can't smoke in the building, why the hell I want to live here?
Yeah.
You know
right.
what I mean? I should be able to do what I want to do in my apartment. And, you know, and so that's one challenge that landlords face, and that's why sometimes our work has fallen on deaf ears, because landlords are saying, I simply want to, you know, just collect my rent. But on the other hand, you know, there are collateral consequences to smoking, which has sat or resonated well. You know, it reduces the amount of work that I have to do to repair the apartment, right? You know, in terms of the coloration of the walls, in terms of the smoke in the ventilation system, in terms of, you know, potential fire issues which are caused by smoking. And so those things are appealing to property owners and property managers, and just the public health issue as we spoke to earlier. And so those things are attractive, and as we've done this work, it seems that we're trending toward smoke-free multi-unit housing policies across the board. HUD was one of the first to, you know, as a governmental agency, to adopt a smoke-free policy in all HUD buildings. So this is it's a real issue. I think we recognize that secondhand smoke, as the U.S. Surgeon General has said, there's no safe level of exposure to it. If you can smell it, you inhale it, and if you are inhaling it, it can exacerbate a number of health-related issues that you already have, or create some.
So moving from tobacco-free norms, talk a little bit about what tobacco-free Erie and Niagara does. I mean, you did a little bit, get more into that, please.
Yeah, so our work is very, very comprehensive. And when I say very, very, it is very, very comprehensive. We've talked about multi-unit housing work, right? Engaging on that level. What we haven't talked about is tobacco-free outdoors, for instance. That would be another initiative that we have. And as I spoke earlier about the Surgeon General's report, there is no safe level of exposure to secondhand smoke. So when you're at the playground, when you're at the park, when you're at the beach, when you're in these outdoor spaces, right? If you're being exposed to secondhand smoke, it can cause harm and will cause harm with repeated exposure. And so our work involves working with elected officials, working with community members to create this sort of education around protecting these spaces, these outdoor spaces, working with employers as well to protect these outdoor spaces. Because if I'm at a space 8, 9, 16 hours a day, right, which we work, and I'm going, you know, and people are allowed to smoke, then that's impacting my health. So we work across not just housing, but also tobacco-free outdoors work sites. And we also have a focus on retail, right? We look at how can we prevent tobacco industry from using marketing to attract, you know, to attract new users, to attract, to continue to perpetuate and sell tobacco products. So we look at a number of different approaches in terms of retail and how the tobacco industry is marketing its product as well.
And so your agenda also includes, you know, bringing together stakeholders to mobilize the community around four priority activities. Can you tell us what those priorities are?
Yeah, and so community engagement is central to the work that we do, right? So we want to make sure that we are creating this sort of awareness. We work directly with communities via listening sessions, via just having conversations. For instance, you know, every November we have, you know, what we call Great American Smokeout, which is really an international movement. And it's about challenging people on one day to not smoke. And we just create this sort of educational awareness piece. We may meet at the Delavan Grotta Community Center with members of the community, and we invite the whole city of Buffalo to be there to support people who are smoking, because our focus is not against people who smoke. Our focus is against tobacco industry and how they're marketing and targeting our communities. So we are about supporting people and helping provide resources for people. But the focus is, again, just about creating that awareness so that people know that there are resources to help them quit. And so community engagement is central to the work that we're doing. Also, we talk about community mobilization. We want the community to be upfront, to use their voice, to have power, to have influence. We talk about government policymaker education. Our focus in my role, my capacity as community engagement program manager, is not to advocate for a particular law, but just simply to educate elected officials about what is happening in a community. And so government policymaker education is central to the work that we're doing, as well as advocacy with organizational decision makers, employers. How are we connecting with HR representatives? Do they have smoke-free policies? And how can we assist them with adopting and implementing these policies? So those are different approaches that we have to actually helping to support New York State smoke-free norms.
I hope the messaging on smoke out is clear, because might attract the wrong folks.
No. You know, it's interesting. We've got some stuff, some smoke for that. You know, we've got some smoke about that. But Great American Smoke Out, right? It does sort of play into that right there. But you know, I mean, it's that day where we work with people who do smoke and encourage them, bring them together, encourage them, and let them know that we are supportive of you know, their efforts to quit. And I just on a personal note, you know, I've had many family members who smoke. My wife smokes, and that's always a challenge because smoking is so personal, and because nicotine is so addictive. You know, I mean, you have to be very sensitive and approach it with compassion, understanding that, you know, there's a habit which is deeply ingrained. And one of the things that I, you know, adopt from my professional life is policy, you know. And what I mean is that in my home, you know, we have a policy of no smoking in the home. And so, you know, that helps in a number of ways. I think one of the things it does, it just makes her conscious of the fact that she is smoking, right? And it also, during the wintertime, what we've noticed is that she smokes less, because if she has to go outside to smoke and it's cold outside, she says, you know, that's one less cigarette I'm going to smoke, or I'm going to cut this one short. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So policy on it, that seems to be so trivial, but on a larger level, policy works because it makes people conscious of what they're doing, and it makes them less likely to do it. It even restricts what they can do in certain spaces.
I wanted to talk about these findings from the Tobacco Retail Environment Observations that CAI did.
Great.
Was 2022?
Well, actually, that should be 2022-2023.
Okay, yes.
So it's sort of kind of major. So that's our year four. You're referring to our year four local data collection report, which essentially was an observation of, I believe, 88 stores in three districts throughout the city of Buffalo.
Largely on the east side.
East
of the city.
Side, correct.
Yes.
I believe it was Lovejoy. It may have been Ellicott
and maybe Maston, I believe.
Yeah, Maston district. And we've since done the remaining six districts as well, which is a report that's currently being worked on for our year five local data collection report. And so you, I'll make sure that you have that once it's completed. But that is our year four local data collection report of the three districts. And essentially what we did was, when we talk about community mobilization, six community members, who we refer to as community champions, were tasked, were trained, and on how to do observations using the forms, and were tasked with going through those three districts and looking at the prevalence of tobacco retail marketing, product sales, and among other things, and what the findings are in that report that you have in front of you. And some of the key findings that we talk about, you know, which is really borderline enforcement, we looked at how there were children in stores selling tobacco, right? Children in stores. Now, in New York State, there's, thankfully, we have a 21 and over law for purchasing tobacco.
Yes.
But in certain stores in throughout the districts that are meant have been mentioned, there were children selling tobacco, right? There were flavored tobacco products, which technically are illegal products, right? And not coincidentally, all of them, I believe, with the exception of one store, sold some form of mentholated tobacco product, right? And, you know, we've already, I think it's well known that, you know, in inner city communities, there is a greater prevalence of mentholated tobacco products, a greater sale and presence of them. 85% of black smokers use mentholated tobacco products. 85%. Think about that. Compared to 30% of white smokers. And that disparity is not coincidental. This is a part of a historic development in of marketing and targeting of African American communities. Back in the 50s, right? You know, when I did my research, you know, less than 5% of black smokers use mentholated tobacco products. In every decade since, there's been this exponential increase where today, from 5% in the 50s to 85% in today. And some would even say 89% of black smokers who smoke use mentholated tobacco products. And you say, well, that's a choice. It isn't.
Right. It isn't. It's ingrained.
It's part of the social norm.
Right.
And so we talk about social norms. Tobacco industry has normalized, African-Americanized, as, you know, Philip Gardner would say, Dr. Philip Gardner would say, African-Americanized mentholated tobacco products. They've made it a part of the black culture.
Right.
It's cool, like, to smoke Newports and, you know.
And we were talking earlier that, you know, you could pick up Jet, you could pick up Ebony back in the day and see these, you know, menthol ads.
Yeah, no
some
question.
Of your favorite actors, actresses,
yes,
recording artists, you know, with that cigarette in their mouth.
Yeah, that
it's
was
almost like Billy D with the St. Ides.
Come on. And yo, and that's how real it was. Like, this is how creative tobacco industry was. Man, they were ahead of the curve when it came to hiring execs. They hire blacks. I mean, before most other industries were doing it.
Right.
You know, they've invested, poured millions of dollars in black schools, historic black universities. Man, they figured out this is a market that we need to exploit. And the way we do it is pour money into it. You know, so when you talk about the advertisement in Jet magazines, like, you know, I'm old enough to remember seeing those advertisements in Ebony, Jet, and all of these health magazines and culturally relevant magazines for black. That was targeted and intentional. And consequently, there is, you find that disproportionate use of those products. So today, Swisher Sweets, cool jazz festivals.
Yeah.
In a lot of the hip hop videos and music videos, you find your cigarillos, those little flavored tobacco products. That is not coincidental. You know, tobacco industry has creatively, found a way to ingrain themselves into the cultural landscape of what it the African American communities.
And then one of the other key findings that menthol cigarettes are widely available across the three districts. 100% of the stores observed across Ellicott, Fillmore, and Lovejoy districts, menthol products were available. I find that astounding.
It is. And when you think about it too, I think we were talking about it earlier, right? You know, the overall prevalence of it, right? It's inescapable, essentially. So repeated exposure to something will have an influence on how you think and how you behave, right? So it's not coincidental why, you know, so many black people prefer menthol tobacco, because it is the most available product.
Can you talk a little bit about the Powerwall?
Nice. Yeah. Powerwall. So that's for people. We're not talking about the lottery here. Yeah, Powerball. We're talking about what in tobacco, the tobacco control landscape. We talk about this Powerwall, right? So you go into a corner store, and you know, and I'm sure all the listeners can have experience connect to this, right? You go into a store and you know, you go to buy a bag of chips, you buy, you know, whatever, wine cooler, whatever you're going to purchase, right? And when you get to the cash register and you look up and it's at eye level, whether you're a kid or whether you're, you know, an adult, and you see this colorful array of products, and they're all tobacco, vape, some sort of nicotine product.
Yes.
Right? It is as clear to as the sky on a, you know, a warm spring day. You can look up and see it, and you saying, wow. For children, a child looking at this, you saying, what the hell is it? Is it? It's colorful. I like it.
Yeah, right.
As an adult, you've already been, let me get the Newport 100s.
Right, yeah. You're green, almost programmed.
No, let me get the green pack, not the red pack.
Yeah.
It's I want you to understand this. The tobacco industry, that Powerwall, is so influential. Tobacco industry pays to have that real estate in every store that you encounter. Every store you go in, that is reserved for the tobacco industry products. That is how they've continued to influence smokers and create this next generation of smokers is by investment in that particular wall.
So what do the numbers from those key findings, what do they say to you?
Well, a number of things. It says that we have a lot of work to do. It says that, you know, in spite of the fact that in New York State, we've had a lot of success with reducing the smoking rate. But the reality is those numbers don't tell us how, you know, certain communities are disproportionately impacted by tobacco, you know, namely the African-American community, namely the LGBTQIA plus community, namely the Latino community, namely, you know, communities that suffer from mental health, communities that, you know, are wrestling with real life issues, like, and who are poor, right? Because, you know, I think under certain under the poverty level, I think the use of tobacco, the use of menthol increases, right? So when you hit a certain level in terms of your ability to make money or even your educational level, there's a correlation between educational level and tobacco use. So those numbers, they tell a story of how tobacco industry is using or exploiting the vulnerabilities of certain populations.
Yes, and it's
that's what the story is.
And it's also, how you mentioned, very intersectional.
Yeah, definitely. It certainly intersects with race. It certainly intersects with economics. Now that you mentioned it, you know, in terms of the race, I think we've already spoken about, you know, menthol and African-American, you know, users. I want to just put this number out here, 45,000 black lives. 45,000 black lives are lost every year in this country as a result of tobacco-related disease and illnesses. That is more than homicides. That is more than suicides. That is more than HIV and AIDS. That is more than accidents combined. 45,000 black lives. lost every year in this country as a result of tobacco-related disease and illnesses in the African-American community, right? That doesn't even include vaping, you know, and the untold story with that, you know, in terms of how tobacco industry is marketed, that and how that's becoming more prevalent in African-American communities, you know, how that's affecting youth overall, the health and well-being of youth. So,
CIA is pushing for... or CAI, excuse me, is now pushing for a menthol cigarette ban within the city of Buffalo. How did that idea come about?
So I just always want to be clear, like in our role as within advancing tobacco-free communities, we are, it's really about government policymaker education. Government policymaker education. I have to be very clear about that. We don't advocate for a particular law. We educate about the issue.
Right.
And we work with community members to educate them.
So it's bringing the issues from the community up
together.
Yes.
So we listen, we learn, and we say, hey, this report says this.
Mm-hmm.
Menthol is a problem, is a public health issue in our communities. How can we use our resources to build capacity so that you have the ability to approach your elected official? You have the information because we will help with you. We work together to produce the information. Community members did the work. Mm-hmm. We just took the information and put it together and told the story. And now we work with community members and we are, you know, when it came to the menthol issue, we've worked with Roswell. We worked with a number of different partners. We've worked with Pastor Nichols, right, from Black Center of Health Equity.
Yeah, shout out to Pastor George.
Yeah, definitely,
bro.
Pastor George.
Love him.
Pastor Mark Blue,
yes,
from, you know, NAACP. Love. We've worked with so many different partners across the city, our community champions, and we've brought them together. My step pops has been before Buffalo Common Council, you know, and done presentations. Some of our colleagues at CAI have presented to the Common Council on this local data collection report. I've been there, my coworker Amanda. So we are menthol, removing menthol from the shelves has been a focus of ours, mm-hmm, because we know, as based on what we've been able to learn, is that menthol is prevalent in our community and it's causing a ton of health issues. And yes, we have been at the forefront, and this didn't happen yesterday. Since I've been in tobacco control over the last 4 years, menthol has been a focus of ours. It continues to be a focus in terms of removing it from the shelves and educating communities about the harms.
And Governor Kathy Hochul has proposed to end the sale of flavored tobacco, mm-hmm, including menthol cigarettes in the state. Pretty big deal?
Yeah, no. Huge. First of all, and I think one of the things we want to certainly acknowledge her courage, because it takes a lot to stand up to the tobacco industry. You know, they spend over $23 million a day on point-of-sale advertisement. I mean, there's a huge amount of money involved with, you know, this product that when used as intended will kill you. But she, last year, she had proposed, you know, removing menthol from the shelves. And, you know, and it's a continuation of national efforts. But locally in New York State, sure, we took, you know, we she just joined our movement.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? And she gave us that statewide support, you know, and so that was a huge issue. What wasn't mentioned too is that there was an increase in the excise tax on tobacco, which also corresponds to a decreased use. So the higher taxes, we noticed that there's a decrease in use. But to the menthol issue, you know, locally in Buffalo, you know, we saw it as an opportunity to just go head first and really do some strong work. And, you know, some of the pastors have went to the state to speak to elected officials as well. Locally here in Buffalo, they traveled to New York to speak to the governor, to speak to elected officials. So that is a huge issue. Though we weren't necessarily successful last year. We will continue to work to educate our elected officials. We have not given up on this issue. It will continue effort. And like all policy related issues, sometimes, you know, it's about building the community will and building that to continue to fight. And I want to give a shout out to Rashid Wyatt, Councilman Bowman, and some of the other elected officials in Buffalo Common Council who have had the courage to say, hey, we are not going to tolerate this anymore. We're going to be a part of what the work that you're doing.
What attracts youth to take up smoking? Is it because someone in their household smokes, friends smoke? Mm-hmm. I ask that because tobacco product placement and advertising isn't really a thing when it's targeted to teenagers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Am I missing something there?
No. I think, so to your question, I think there is, it's a multi-layer piece to it. I think nowadays we talked about advertisement, the power wall, mm-hmm. right? This stuff is part of the culture. I go in a store, for instance, and this, you know, you got individuals in the store smoking.
Right.
I go to the DMV. I go to my family's house. I have a cousin who's pregnant. She has a vape in her hand. She carries it around like it's a cell phone. Or, you know what I mean? It's so prevalent now. And we take it for granted. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to youth, we're so impressionable.
Yeah.
The average age of a new smoker in New York State is 13.
Wow.
In schools, they're finding, elementary schools, kids in 7th, 6th grade, they're finding vape products. They got vape detectors in these schools now. Why are they attracted to it? The flavors.
Mm-hmm. How are they finding these
vape? That's a great question.
I mean, is it like a black market thing?
Well, what I want to say, we call it illicit market.
Yeah.
But I'm to your point, I think part of it is sometimes is older folks who are getting it for them. You know, I mean, that's not new. We did that when we were younger.
True.
We wanted alcohol, you know, yeah. We get to buy older to buy it from. Sometimes it's finding their parents' vape products.
Yes.
And, you know, sometimes it is having older peer friends who can get it for them, who look older, and these stores are not checking IDs. So there are a number of ways, but at the heart of it is the flavors.
Mm-hmm.
The flavor is what attracts. They got the menthol flavor. They got the fruity flavors, grape, peach, mango.
Right.
It tastes good.
Uh-huh.
And it's cool.
It's like new flavors of Gatorade.
Yeah, almost, like, yeah, you know? And it's cool. Like, yeah. It's so cool. But the problem is when you start using it, you don't realize that there's unregulated levels of nicotine.
Mm.
And nicotine is one of the most addictive substances in the world. And with menthol, it is easier to start and harder to quit.
Mm-hmm.
That's that cool sensation you feel in your throat.
Yes.
That makes it, I like the way this feel.
Which for a lot of years was advertised as being less harmful than regular cigarettes.
Yes. And again, tobacco industry creatively marketing a product that, you know, manipulated us into thinking that it was less harmful. And it was actually considered to be a health benefit,
mm-hmm.
you know. But the reality is with menthol, what it does is make the poison go down easier.
Right.
If you can, without it, you notice like, mm-hmm. what the hell is that? Your throat is telling you. But menthol tricks.
Yes.
It tricks you. It makes you realize, oh, this ain't bad. I can inhale it more deeply. I can inhale more of it. And if I'm inhaling it more deeply and I'm inhaling more of it, then I am ingesting more poison, more toxin, and it's causing more harm.
Mm-hmm.
Consequently, it makes it easier to start and harder to quit.
And I know we spent a lot of time talking about implementation for the inner city,
mm-hmm.
especially Buffalo's east side, but this is tobacco-free Erie and Niagara.
Correct.
So you have outreach in the rural areas. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, no, that and that's always you know, I appreciate just on a personal level being able to do that work in such a diverse community, because it allows for me to see so much more about how diverse you know, Western New York is. You know, I could be,
because you're a kid from the East Side.
Yeah, I'm right from the Fruit Belt, right here, you know, right here in the Fruit Belt, and I could be in Springville in one afternoon, and the next day I could be in North Tonawanda, mm-hmm. which is where I live, by the way. Now, let me just be completely transparent. You know, working with Community Health Alliance of North Tonawanda, you know, on some policy and community work, right? And it gives me an opportunity to see what the needs are, the unique set of needs are in those communities. What are the social issues? What are the health issues? And to say, hey, I never thought of it that way. How can I add value to the work that you're doing? You mm-hmm. know, you know, and but at the heart of it too, when you go, there are some parallels. There are a lot of different common issues. You know, flavors and vaping is impacting every community. You go to Springville, they're talking about the prevalence of vaping. You go to North Tonawanda, you're talking about the prevalence of vaping. You go to Niagara Falls, you talk about these vape products and how children are getting caught in school with them, how children are being suspended, and how children are being impacted in terms of their development, their brain development. And the less time you spend in school, the least likely you are to graduate.
Correct.
And learn. And mm-hmm. so this is something that is impacting, you know, not just Black kids in Niagara Falls or Buffalo, but in Springville as well, in Wilson as well, in Marilla, mm-hmm. in Elma, in these other places that I've had the opportunity to go to. And at the end of the day, there is a human element.
Yes.
There's a human element that I think connects all of us. And whenever I'm in any room, whether I'm the only Black person in that room, you know, I find a space. I try to connect with the humanity of people there. You know what I mean? And that's where I feel comfortable at, and I find a space to add value to whatever community that I'm in.
Yeah, and then tailoring that education to the communities, as we were talking earlier. Again, you may, like, vaping is kind of like a very broad issue, mm-hmm. but you know, if you're in the city of Niagara Falls or you're in Buffalo, you may be talking about having conversations about menthol cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're out in the rural areas, you may be talking about, you know, regular like Marlboros or Camels or the nicotine.
Yeah,
pouches,
the Zen
like
pouches.
Exactly.
And the different sort of spitless tobacco pouches, right? So there are certain cultural pieces that, you know, that you find to be true, and you just try to understand what they are. You know, instead of presuming that you know, mm-hmm. and I resist going into communities thinking that I have an answer. I go there thinking that I can be a part of helping find a solution. My expertise in understanding policy and understanding health equity and understanding, you know, tobacco. I bring that to the table, but I don't know what the unique set of needs are. I listen and try to understand, and then I weigh in on how, you know, being a part of the creative process of finding a solution, a policy solution, is where I think, you know, we sit at. And I think that's one of the hallmarks of the organization that I work for, Cicatelli Associate.
We kind of mentioned this before about the tobacco lobby in this country. Going up against them is kind of like, you know, facing the Pat Mahomes era Kansas City Chiefs.
You know what? You just traumatized me with that. You know, goodness. Yeah, like, you know, it's a challenge, man. Like Brady, man. Like, you know what I mean? You talk about Holmes. Brady terrorized us for 17 years, man. We couldn't sniff the playoffs or the division title. You know,
right.
But these are, you know what I mean, when it comes to tobacco industry, man,
$23 million
a day at point of sale marketing. $23 million. That's insane.
It is.
That's a machine that has that perpetuates a product that when used as intended will kill you. There's a reason why over 500,000 people die in this country from tobacco-related disease and illnesses. Tobacco remains the leading cause of preventable death in this country. Remains. Let's be clear about that. And it's a reason they pour insane amounts of money. They lobby effectively to make sure that you and I continue to have access and to a product that when used as intended will kill you. That is an insane amount of money. You know,
I'm glad you keep repeating that, that a product that will kill you.
It will. That has been proven. That's scientifically, empirically proven that tobacco use, nicotine will kill you. Secondhand smoke will kill you. It always astounds me that people say, what's your issue against smoking and secondhand smoke? And I'm saying, excuse me, are you not aware that this product will kill? It says the label.
Exactly.
It says it right on the label. And thanks to the work of tobacco control professionals, it's on the label because tobacco industry fought for decades to restrict that. They didn't want that on there. You know, but today now, we've had some successes, and that's again part of the normalization of community awareness, community education. We want you to see this. When you pick this up, there is a notice on there that this may cause cancer.
Right.
You know, so we want you to be aware of the fact that this product, when used as intended, will kill you.
So what's next for tobacco-free Erie and Niagara and CAI? What have you got coming up in May?
So currently, when we talk about May is one of those days we talk about World No Tobacco Day. We're also talking about No Menthol Sunday. So this is a part of a national movement, No Menthol Sunday is, started by the Center for Health Equity. And we are a part of this larger national movement, and we adopted it locally where we work with faith-based communities to create awareness. When I say faith-based communities, I'm not just referring to churches. I'm referring to mosques, Jewish communities, synagogues, and whatever religious tradition and that we can find. We want to just provide education. We want to mobilize them to be a part of this larger discussion on how menthol and flavored tobacco is impacting communities of color, vulnerable populations. So on this day is a day of providing education where we want, you know, pastors, we want rabbis, we want, you know, imams to educate their congregants. We provide educational material. We want them to put it in their news bulletin boards. We want this to be a part of the conversation that is being had about health equity, you know, about health, the impact of, you know, tobacco and specifically menthol. So again, No Menthol Sunday is that national day of observance where we are working with faith-based community. And this year happens to land on May 19th. We'll have more information. I'll leave my contact information. We'll be doing some organization and some education at some faith-based communities in Buffalo as well as in Niagara Falls.
And where can folks find more about these findings from the tobacco retail environment observations?
Yeah, so you can certainly contact me. My name is Rashawn Smalls. My email address is rsmalls@caiglobal.org. rsmalls@caiglobal.org. Or you can just simply go to our website. My contact information is there. You can learn more about the work that we're doing with advancing tobacco-free communities. And that's CAI or Chickatelli Associates. You can get more information about our local data collection project. And I mentioned that year 4 you have in your possession, but year 5 is currently being worked on, which completes the 9 districts observation. And we'll have a more comprehensive look at how tobacco industry is, impacting our communities and what we can do about it.
And that's the 9 common council districts in the city.
And throughout the city of Buffalo. Yeah. Yep.
You're listening to What's Next. I want to thank my guests, Rashawn Smalls from Tobacco Free Erie and Niagara, and Chickatelli Associates for being on with us today, man. Rashawn, it's been real, man.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. And if I may, I always want to plug in our Quitline, New York State's Quitline.
Absolutely.
You know, which is our partners at Roswell. You know, anyone interested in desiring to quit smoking, you can call 1-866-NEW-YORK-QUITS, 1-866-NEW-YORK-QUITS. Believe it or not, the Quitline is right here in your backyard at Roswell Park. You know, you can call there and get access to nicotine replacement therapy, or short for NRT. That is professional coaching and some other resources. So definitely don't hesitate. It's a free service as well, and there is no limit to how often you can use it. So call 1-866-NEW-YORK-QUITS to get resources on how to quit. And thank you. It's been a blast, and I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You're listening to What's Next. We'll be back with more after this.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
For our second segment on today's What's Next, we revisit a conversation with Dr. Gary Giovino from earlier in 2024. He's a SUNY Distinguished Professor Emeritus at the University at Buffalo's Department of Community Health and Health Behavior. Here, Dr. Giovino breaks down some other factors that research reveals may be linked to tobacco use and how that may be changing.
Maybe about 10 years ago, you were the senior author of a study that found large tobacco use and the extent of tobacco use among men and women in low and middle income countries throughout the world. I'm really curious about that because this obviously examines the link between income and tobacco use. And I'm kind of curious if you can talk about that and maybe like to what extent tobacco use was actually tied to income and where those were actually highlighted.
Sure. The picture on socioeconomic disparities is clearer in the United States than it is around the world. I think that's in part based on where countries are in the stage of the epidemic of taking up cigarettes, because if they're early on, as Africa would be, for example, if they're in the earlier stage of the epidemic of the uptake of tobacco use, then it's the wealthier people who are targeted and who will use. After a while, the wealthier, more educated people realize it's not so good. But in the process, the lesser educated, lower SES people use it and may have even gotten hooked on it. In the United States, that was the case. In the beginning, it was movie stars and very influential people, politicians. They used athletes that might have promoted cigarette smoking. But then as we look at the trends over time, the better educated people, the people with more income, led the way in discontinuing cigarette smoking, in part because physicians were the first group to really quit in the United States, which was great. The disparities between the better educated and the lesser educated widened, so much so now that 40 or 50 years ago in the United States, there wasn't much of a gradient between lesser educated people and the people with the most education. Now there's a 3 or 4 difference, lesser educated people being 3 or 4 times more likely to smoke than people who are college graduates or even, you know, with graduate degrees or physicians and lawyers. I think part of that is based on education. I think part of that is based on ability to control their behavior. I think part of that is based on availability. A lot of people who don't have a lot of money will say, this is my only pleasure. And if you throw in the fact that a menthol cigarette is part of that equation of what's pleasurable, then that will really be an influencing factor as well.
I'm also curious about the tie between tobacco use and to take one example, talking from an epidemiology standpoint, diet, because we know that tobacco use can cause cancer. We also know that, you know, a plant-based diet, or, you know, there are indications that there are very clear dietary changes that a person can make that are healthier both for themselves and also for carbon footprint. What is tobacco's role in the global picture as we think about, you know, for example, the UN Sustainable Development Goals, the Paris Agreement, all that stuff? What is tobacco's role in all that? Is it just as simple as we need to get rid of tobacco use and focus on other things? I mean, is that what the role of it is in the larger picture?
In the 90s, I started finding studies. More and more studies came out that looked at the diets of cigarette smokers. It turns out that people who smoke cigarettes had worse diets based on the dietary guidelines than people who either never smoked or were long-term quitters of cigarettes. And by that, it meant more red meat, more refined and processed foods like cakes and candies and soda pop and fewer fruits and vegetables. And those were like the top of mind findings. Smokers were more likely to drink coffee, which I could relate to. So what I did was I put together all of the studies were coming out. And most of these studies were done by epidemiologists, and they were more or less like, oh, should diet be considered a control variable when they look at smoking and heart disease and smoking and other cancers, certain cancers. And you know, that was a pretty important issue. And then I thought, well, maybe smokers have different diets, or, you know, maybe bad diets cause smoking, because these were cross-sectional studies. And, you know, quite honestly, my initial interpretation was these folks are smokers. They smoke. What do they care about diet? But then I realized that in cross-sectional studies, we don't know the direction of the relationship. So I asked the question, is there any directionality here? And I got some money from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and I think at the time, the American Legacy Foundation. And from Robert Wood Johnson, it was an Innovators Combating Substance Use Award. And I developed a survey to look at 1,000 people who smoked. And there was a national survey. And the major point of the survey was to try to document a phenomenon called hardcore smoking. But I also added questions from the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance Survey. It's a national surveillance system that the CDC has been using for decades. And I added their questions on fruit and vegetable consumption at the baseline of the survey. So we have 1,000 smokers at baseline. I think it was 1,001. And we asked them a lot of questions, so much detail about their smoking, including measures of addiction. And we asked them about fruit and vegetable consumption. On average, 14 months later, we ended the study, having followed up 750 of the smokers. 75% response rate is pretty good. And dare I say, especially with cigarette smokers, who are a little bit tougher group to follow. The findings were, well, first of all, at baseline, we found very interestingly that, remember, all these people were smokers. The more cigarettes they smoked each day, the fewer fruits and vegetables they ate each day. The more cigarettes they smoked each day compared to people who smoke fewer cigarettes, those who smoke more cigarettes scored higher on three measures of addiction. So that was all very interesting. But then we looked at the follow-up. So the follow-up question is, were the people who were eating the most fruits and vegetables more likely to quit smoking? And the answer was yes. We looked at quartiles, four different groups from low, medium, moderate, and high, you know, low, four tiers, four strata, as we say. And the people in the highest strata, they weren't like whole food raw vegans. They averaged four or more servings of fruits and vegetables a day. This was nationally representative data. So we found that the smokers who ate the most fruits and vegetables were three times more likely to quit smoking. But there have been other studies, other cohort studies, and a meta-analysis of those studies did conclude that smokers who eat more fruits and vegetables are more likely to quit smoking than those who eat fewer fruits and vegetables.
Dr. Gary Giovino, SUNY Distinguished Professor Emeritus at the University at Buffalo's Department of Community Health and Health Behavior, thank you so much for joining us on What's Next.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.